views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to our Friday morning California Time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. And a couple of real quick announcements before we start in. Number one, we're on the 60-minute format this morning. So if you have a question or comment for our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, do pay attention to the clock because, as I said, we're doing the 60-minute format. And then just a real quick word about my future schedule. We do have a Sunday space show as planned. And Monday, retired astronaut Tom Jones is back with us. And then there will be no shows on Tuesday, no Hotel Mars, no show on Friday, no show on Sunday due to my needing to be in Los Angeles for medical reasons. And then we will resume the following Monday. So you'll see all of that on the newsletter. But I just wanted to, you know, repeat it once again. So, again, welcome to our Friday show. For those of you who can call us today and speak with our guest, it is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Please let the phone ring. I'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also get a hold of us through email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and also through our blog, which is on our spaceshow.com website. If you don't know how to do that through our blog, email me and I'll send you a very short set of instructions. And then the newsletter gets updated on Sunday, so make sure you see that on Sunday afternoon. And remember that everything we do is archived on our website, thespaceshow.com. There is a menu in the upper left, so check out support because that's where we have our Space Show store. And then also listen live. This tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs, archive programs on the website, which are MP3, podcast on our various podcast services, and whatever your device may be. And then those of you using Alexa, the tune-in player is embedded, and you can listen right off of our website to the Space Show on Alexa. And then do remember we are a nonprofit 501c3 listener-supported program. So if you like what we do and like our programming, please do support us. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction since we are a 501c3. If you're fortunate enough to be paying California taxes, the highest in the country, you get a tax deduction as well. We're a public benefit corporation here in California. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check them out. If you have any other questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You're free to download our shows and share them. It's easier to send out the URL, but still you're free to share our programming with everyone. And remember, there are 3 simple rules to that. Don't do anything commercial with our programs. No edits, cuts, or clips. No uploads to YouTube or any other website, including your own personal one. And written transcripts are not permitted, even for your own personal website. And if you do feel you have a compelling need to do something with our Space Show program, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and let's work it out before you do it. And our copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our website pages for thespaceshow.com, as well as our nonprofit pages, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We also do have sponsors, and they get a banner ad running across our website. You can change that banner ad as often as you like. And on regular length shows, I read a short message from each sponsor. But on programs such as today, I simply acknowledge and thank all of our sponsors. So I do thank the National Space Society. They're a sponsor. The Space Development Network for Space Settlement is a sponsor. We thank that. The Space Symposium and the Space Foundation, they are a sponsor, and they just completed their 34th symposium. Integrated Space Plan, we appreciate them and thank them as a sponsor. Our guest today is from Orbital ATK, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute. And Orbital ATK is a great sponsor. AIAA as well, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and Celestis, still the only proven Memorial spaceflight service provider there is. So if you have any questions about any of our sponsors, I'm happy to take your emails. And we appreciate all of them. If you're interested in sponsorship, do let me know. So our guest today is Michael Laidley, and his full bio is on the Space Show website, so you can read it. But roughly and quickly, because we're on the shorter format today, he has over 25 years' experience in the aerospace industry, with over 20 years of experience at Orbital ATK. He is currently the vice president of the Omega program for the company's launch vehicle, which is what we're going to talk about in a few minutes. In this capacity, he leads the integrated program office for the development of the Omega rocket. He's also worked on Antares. He's also been involved in other orbital and suborbital programs for Minotaur 1 and 2 launch development programs, other things with the Air Force. And I really urge you to read his full bio on the website. It's very impressive, and we're most fortunate to have Michael with us today. Mike, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
Well, thank you, David, for the wonderful introduction, and I'm really happy to be here and talk to you today about the Omega launch vehicle.
So tell us something about us. Introduce us to this new launch vehicle.
Excellent. Okay. Well, in 2015, the Air Force announced a program to replace the RD-180 Russian-provided engine that's used to power many of our national security space missions. So the Air Force announced a development initiative to go out and jointly fund with industry some propulsion development activities to replace the RD-180. And Orbital ATK at the time proposed a segmented solid booster system to replace the RD-180. So the design we put together, we call CBS, or Common Booster System. It's based on the technology, the tried and true technology that we developed and flew many times under the shuttle era, of a segmented solid rocket motor. So we didn't make many updates and changes. We're in the process of qualifying our new design, but it'll be a segmented solid motor case. So we'll put different segments together to support the first stage, and then the second stage of our vehicle will be a single segment. Each segment's about 350,000 pounds of propellant. And we're redesigning the cases. Those of you who remember the reusable solid rocket motor that provided the strap-on capability for the shuttle, those were steel cases that were parachuted down, recovered, and then refurbed and repoured. So what we're doing for our CBS program on Omega is we're developing those segmented cases out of composite. So we've got automated fiber placement, winding machines where we're doing large composite cases that then will join together to form segments. And each of these segments we call, one segment, as I said, is about 350,000 pounds of propellant. And our first stage for the intermediate Omega vehicle is a two segment. So it's what we call a C600. And, that motor forms the, foundation for our intermediate class, and then the second stage for that vehicle is a C300. So it's a single segment stage design, and then we also announced recently that we've selected the RL-10 as a cryogenic engine for our third stage. So this will be a three-stage rocket that will use solid motor propulsion for the first two stages, and then we'll use an RL-10, a LOX hydrogen stage, for the third stage. And what we're developing as part of this program for the Air Force, this joint development for the Air Force, we need to put together a vehicle family that can support all the mission requirements for these EELV missions, what I think everyone has heard of with regard to EELV missions that are currently flown on Atlas V, Delta IV, or Falcon 9. So there's a range of missions that that each competitor needs to be able to show that they can fly to be an entrant into this into the opportunity to bid on these missions. And so we're putting together two vehicles, an intermediate class and a heavy class vehicle. So the heavy class vehicle will be similarly designed. It'll have four segment first stage. So a C-1200 would be our four segment first stage. It'll have a C-300 for the second stage, and then for the third stage, it'll have a similar cryogenic RL-10 based stage. It'll be a little bigger from a propellant load perspective, but it'll be a very similar design. So this vehicle is really the product of the merger between Orbital Sciences Corporation and ATK that occurred in early 2015. So that merger brought all the pieces together into our company to produce a large class vertically integrated launch system. So I work out of the Chandler, Arizona facility. This is our launch vehicle division where we do launch vehicle development activities and launch vehicle production. So we have about 10 rocket systems in production now that we field for various customers. And this will be our largest and biggest as we add it to our family of vehicles.
So, but you have to, correct me if I'm wrong, win a competition with the Air Force to get the bid. Is that correct, or does the Air Force give a bid to multiple companies?
Yeah, that's right. So in 2016, we won the first phase of this, which was really to provide, to develop the technology for the rocket propulsion system for the first stage, which was the RD-180. We submitted a proposal to the Air Force last November for the launch service agreement phase, which is the next phase. And this phase involves taking that, those propulsion elements that were conceived of and developed during the earlier phase and putting them into a launch system that will meet those full EELV mission requirements. And this is kind of a special type of contract with the Air Force. It's called an OTA, or an other transaction agreement. And what that means is that it's designed to allow the Air Force to contribute along with industry under a joint development plan. So industry contributes some portion of the development money. The government contributes a portion of the development money, and in the end, the idea being that the government has access to a product that meets their unique needs and requirements, and industry also has developed a capability that is marketable not just to the government but also to commercial customers.
Who do you compete against in this contest? Do you have a lot of competitors, or do you own the market, so to speak?
So, you know, I think in the smaller launch vehicles, we've been dominant in the marketplace over the years. We've, you know, had our Pegasus vehicle and our Minotaur vehicles, and Taurus and Antares. I think we've largely been in markets that don't have a lot of competition. I know there's a lot of new growth in the new space community in the smaller launch area, but ours are typically a little larger than those. In this next generation launcher, of course, with the larger capacity, we certainly envision competitors. This is a very competitive market with the SpaceX Falcon 9. ULA has announced their Vulcan vehicle that is competing in this same, government contracting agreement, and Blue Origin also appears to be interested in proposing a new Glenn vehicle to meet these government requirements. So we see this as certainly a competitive environment, but again, as a product of the merger between Orbital Sciences and ATK, we think we're uniquely positioned as a publicly traded company to come in and offer value to the Air Force.
Do you have a timeline for, if everything goes correctly, when you would be operational?
Sure. So over the next few months, again, I said we submitted the proposal for this next phase of joint funding to the Air Force in November. We expect to hear final determination on that this summer. So we think by the end of July or early August, the Air Force will select three participants to move forward into the next phase. So out of the four I mentioned before, we expect three to receive some level of matching funds with the Air Force to move forward into the next phase. And over the next 3 or 4 years, we'll be developing our launch system. And we plan for initial flight of our intermediate configuration in 2021. And then initial flight of our heavy configuration will occur in roughly 2024. So those meet the government's requested timelines for when they need new vehicles that are capable of supporting their launch needs, their assured access to space requirements.
You have an email that has come in from Jack in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says, I certainly can understand you're going after Air Force and national security and NASA business, but you also mentioned commercial markets. What would be the application for either the intermediate or the heavy in the commercial arena? And also, do you have any plans where maybe one of these versions would be human rated?
Great question. So, as far as commercial arena, we're looking very, very heavily at geostationary satellites. There's a market there to insert geostationary satellites for commercial customers. Orbital ATK is in kind of a unique position amongst the offers that we discussed in the sense that we have a satellite production capability in-house as well. So a lot of times, if you look through the news, you'll see that Orbital ATK satellites fly on Atlas V. They fly on Falcon 9. So they fly on launch vehicles that other providers, sell to us. And I think we've got a very real opportunity to try to keep those delivery and orbit services in-house. So we certainly see an opportunity to capture some number of commercial missions for geostationary, also science payloads and science missions over the coming years. So we see a joint market for our launch system, not just to support government and national security payloads, but also these commercial and civil market payloads. As far as man rating, right now we're not working towards a man rating plan for the Omega launch system. We do participate in man rating systems for other providers. We're a provider for SLS and the solid rocket booster strap-ons that provide a huge percentage of the thrust for the SRS vehicle, SLS vehicle. So we kind of understand man-rated systems, but at this point in time, we're really focusing on this commercial market and the national security space market. As a publicly traded company, we need to provide value to our stockholders. We have a duty to our stockholders to kind of meter our development and to provide products that have near-term markets for them. And so we're really focused in the near term on providing a vehicle system that can be competitive in this large class space market.
I have another email question for you. It's kind of a little off the topic, but not much.
Sure.
Paula is in Boston, and she says, my question is really two-part. Since you have been making solid rocket boosters forever, now that you're making them for this new family of rockets and others as well, do you actually use the same chemical compound you just redesign how it's going to work and flow and the casing, or do you have to create new chemical compounds for the solid propulsion fuel? I'll ask you that one first.
Okay, that's a great question. So we do have a long history of producing solid rocket motors for many different applications. We currently produce motors for strategic markets like the D5. We've built a lot of the Minuteman and Peacekeeper motor assets, and we currently produce motors for our Pegasus and Minotaur. That's the Orion class solid rocket motors, and then SLS. And all of these motors use variants of a similar formula. So the formula needs to be varied somewhat based on the thrust that we want to produce, the size of the motor, the profile that we want to get. There's a thrust profile as the motor burns that we tailor specifically. So there's things like burn rate characteristics, and there's also the mechanical properties of the propellant that we need to tailor based on the size of the motor. So there's certainly variations. And you know, the other thing that happens occasionally is you'll see material obsolescence in some of the ingredients, some of the constituent ingredients that we use. So what we used 20 years ago may no longer be available today to use in our motor products. But we have a very talented team of scientists and chemists in our Utah plant that update the formulas for these solid rocket motors and ensure that they're a highly reliable and dependable form of energy release for our vehicles. So, you know, pretty exciting stuff. I don't know if any of our listeners have the opportunity to go on YouTube and see some of the videos from the static fire tests. We did an SLS test, I think, maybe a year or so ago. Certainly, the static fire testing activities of those solid motors are impressive, and there's a lot of energy pent up in them. I will say, you know, as we talked about the CBS development activities, they're a little ahead of the launch vehicle. So the CBS segmented booster design is actually going through kind of a verification stage now. The design activities are complete, and just this week we finished casting our first inert segment. So that was about 340,000 pounds of inert propellant that we cast, and that's kind of the first phase in testing out all of our manufacturing processes and the tooling that is used to make sure that the propellant cast meets all of our requirements. So we got through that, I think, on Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. It was just a monumental effort. It was, I think, the largest single pour of a solid rocket motor that we've ever done. And again, it was inert this time around. We'll do the actual rocket motor later this summer, the first time we pour a live propellant, but absolutely exciting times as we move through the initial design activities and the verification for this new launch system.
The second part of her question was, do you think the Omega rocket will make rideshare possibilities available for CubeSats and academic and other types of launches?
Absolutely. Orbital ATK is a key member of the small launch community. We support the small launch environment on our small vehicles, on Pegasus and Minotaur and Antares. We routinely have CubeSat and secondary payloads that we fly, and we're planning on that for the Omega launch system as well. So we're looking at opportunities to have multiple payload adapters that would enable ride along opportunities for the smaller satellites or smaller payloads. So we certainly support those activities. And if you look back through our history, we've got a pretty good track record of launching multiple payloads on our vehicles.
An email came in from Alan in Houston. He says, I'm curious as to the demand for this rocket. So when it's actually operational, how many launches a year from all users would you expect?
That's a great question. So one of the things as a publicly traded company we have to do is we have to put together a very robust return on investment analysis. I would say next to the rocket equation here, the return on investment equation is one that we use a lot to verify that the investments that we make as a company provide the return that our shareholders expect. So we've looked really hard at the market going forward. We believe that we can actually be successful with a return on an investment with a relatively small number of launches per year. And one of the reasons we can do that is because we have a very diverse business base here. As I said, we have about 10 products in our launch vehicle division that we provide for our customers. We've got about 1,500 employees in this group. So we're a pretty lean organization in the sense that we service a lot of different rocket products with a relatively small number of people, and we share resources across our programs. We also share components and key systems across multiple launch vehicles. So we feel like we can have a solid business case with about three or four launches per year. We think, you know, eight launches or so a year would be a sweet spot. That's where we'd love to be, and we could certainly do more than that if the market demands. But when we look at the return on investment for a system like this, we need to be realistic with regard to what we think the sales expectations are going to be going forward. So we'll look and say, okay, well, I think we can get a couple of government missions a year. We think we can get a couple of civil missions a year, and we need to be able to close our business case at those rates and not require, you know, a launch a month or two launches a month to be able to close our business case and meet the return on investment that's expected. So that's kind of the ballpark we're in is 4 to 6 or 4 to 8.
And then you're launching primarily at the Cape. So have you had to remodel a launch complex for this? And then are you planning, given national security and military, polar launches out of Vandenberg?
Yes, that's right. So we are working on a formal agreement. About 2 years ago, the Air Force, or I'm sorry, NASA KSC issued a call for potential companies to come in and use a portion of the vertical assembly building at KSC, kind of the iconic launch structure where the shuttles and Saturn rockets were processed. So we put together a proposal for Omega to use High Bay Number 2 in the VAB. We also put together a proposal to take over the mobile launch platform number 3. So one of those mobile launch platforms that would roll out the shuttle from the VAB on the crawler and then launch off of the facilities at pad 39A or 39B. So we were selected by NASA for that agreement. So we're in the process of kind of finalizing the terms and conditions of that agreement as we get through the summer and get selected for the next phase. We'll solidify that agreement and begin to occupy High Bay Number 2 in the vehicle assembly building and modify that MLP to support the Omega launch system. As far as West Coast capability, we're planning our West Coast capability to come online in the 2024 timeframe. 2024-2025 is when the Air Force is requiring that for the polar launch capability, and we're looking at a couple of different facilities there that we think we can bring online then. So there's some trade studies in work and discussions in place with the folks at Vandenberg, but we certainly envision developing a launch capability out of Vandenberg.
Here's another question for you. Boy, I would have never, before this show started, thought you would have gotten these questions. Okay, Todd is in San Diego, and he said, given that you're using solid fuel rockets, there is a lot of concern about what solid fuels do to atmospheric emissions. Is there any way you've cleaned up your emissions on solid fuel launchers, or is there a way to deal with the emissions and the chemicals that get thrown into the atmosphere?
Yeah, I don't have too much information on exactly what the combustion products are from solid rocket fuels. I know that, you know, when we look at the overall, you know, we're basically burning ammonium perchlorate, you know, AP and a resin. I'm really not up to speed enough to really comment on that, David.
Are you going to be, do you have your pricing set on the commercial side, or is that all to be determined down the road?
Great question. So we are in a competition at this phase of the procurement. So right now we are in a competitive phase for the development activities under the LSA agreement. We expect an award from that in the summer, in the summer 2018, this summer. And then about a year and a half from now, the Air Force will go through the next phase where they'll purchase the recurring missions or procurement phase activities for these ELV class missions. And at that point in time, probably about a year from now, we'll be asked for a proposal with our pricing structure for the government missions. And so we really don't want to give away too much of where we're going to come in with regard to pricing because of the competitive nature of that of that procurement that's going to happen about a year from now. So I can say we're going to be competitive. You know, if we didn't feel like we were going to be competitive, we would not have gotten the approval from our board of directors to go invest the amount of money that we're going to have to invest, which is certainly a significant. It'll be the biggest development program that Orbital ATK has done. You know, we certainly had to put together a solid business plan that included not only the development costs but the recurring costs and what we thought the market would bear. So that's really all I can say on pricing is we expect to be competitive.
As the Omega goes into service, do you plan on phasing out or eliminating some of the older launchers or smaller launchers, or is your existing launcher portfolio going to stay intact?
We do not expect Omega to replace any of our existing launch products. I mean, this is really a new capability for us. This is a new launch market for Orbital ATK, and it's complementary to the other products that we offer to our customers. So at this point in time, our vision is that Omega will capture a market that we currently do not capture in the large class satellites, the national security payloads, and things like that. So we're not envisioning a change. This is kind of adding to our stable and not planning to replace anything.
Can you sell a launch to a foreign entity or a foreign government, or do laws preclude that?
So as far as sales, we can provide launch services to foreign satellites. So our plan is to fly domestically. There are ITAR restrictions with regard to the amount of data that we can transfer about the working details of our launch system. But typically when you sell a launch service, the amount of technical data that you provide is pretty limited. So we certainly are well-versed in the ITAR restrictions with regard to what we can share and what we can't share. But the foreign marketplace is certainly open to us from a satellite launch perspective.
Here's another one from Sally in Denver, Colorado, and she says, perhaps you can clear up some of the confusion. My question is not strictly about Orbital ATK, but it would apply to Orbital ATK. I understand that rockets have gotten bigger and they have more capability, so actually larger payloads and more rockets, more satellites can be launched on one single rocket, therefore reducing the number of launchers that are actually needed. Is this a factual statement? Does it apply to what you're doing? And if you can do more with less, then how does that affect your ROI?
Great question. So we do see there has been a general trend towards smaller satellites. As geostationary satellites have developed technologies like electric propulsion and things like this, the need for them to carry large reserves of fuel has been reduced. So there is some reduction in the net size or the net mass of satellites as their designs have evolved. But what we've really seen is that the satellite manufacturers and the satellite designers kind of understand the capabilities of the launch systems that are going to put them in orbit. So while they may need less mass to support a propulsion system or a station-keeping system for a geostationary satellite, they will augment the satellite with additional transponders or additional capability so that they can sell more service or get more value out of that individual satellite compared to what they do before. So you almost see a balancing in the masses of the satellites that are being launched. I think there's some reduction in the sense that the systems are becoming more efficient, the electronics are becoming smaller, and the propulsion systems are becoming more efficient, more mass efficient anyway. But what we've seen is there's still a market for these large class satellites, and certainly for the national security efforts, those very important efforts tend to drive the top end capabilities of our vehicles. So when we've sat down and designed our satellites, it's kind of the high end performance requirements that the government wants to make sure these systems are capable of flying that drives the bounds of our system design. And then when we step back and we look at, okay, well, how can we fly a commercial satellite? Typically they fall within that. Now, one of the things that we haven't talked about is strap-on boosters. So as part of the Omega system, we're planning to fly the GEM-63 XL strap-on booster. So those that have seen the Atlas V launch, are familiar with the idea of having multiple solid strap-on boosters around the perimeter of the first stage. The beauty in those strap-on boosters is that they allow us to tailor the mission requirements very specifically for the payload that we're flying. So we can fly anywhere from 0 to 6 strap-on boosters for the Omega launch system on both the intermediate and heavy class. So that's an opportunity for us to make sure that the vehicle we launch is really tailored to the satellite that we're going to deliver, and we don't have a lot of extra energy that is wasted.
So how many strap-ons would be on your heavy version of the Omega rocket?
So the heavy version is a C-1200, so it's a 4-segment solid motor with 6 strap-ons is kind of the top-end capability. So, the C-1200 motor will have about 3.1 million pounds of thrust. And then each of these strap-on motors is on a 400,000 pounds of additional thrust. So clearly a very powerful rocket as it takes off. And those are really envisioned for a couple of unique missions that the government requires us to be able to fly.
So you wouldn't expect that to be the main version of the rocket being used then? Correct. The intermediate would get the bigger market share.
That's exactly right. Especially from a commercial perspective, we really envision the heavy configuration to be uniquely, it's a configuration that would uniquely provide the government the large launch opportunities they need for their national security mission. So we believe the intermediate class with anywhere from 0 to 6 strap-ons would provide the capabilities that are needed to deliver geostationary satellites and cover the commercial market.
So one of the trends we've been seeing over the past couple of years is this excitement and enthusiasm, I guess are the words to use, for reusability and flying used components. I guess I can call them used components, previously owned. Is there any reusability with your strap-on boosters or any of the stages?
That's a great question. So we have, over the years, we've looked at reusability pretty heavily, and certainly the shuttle solid rocket boosters had a reusable component to them. For the Omega launch system, we are not moving down the path of reusability. Instead, we've chosen a path of commonality with our other launch products. So as I said before, we got multiple products in the production line here. We develop our own avionics. We develop a lot of our own subsystems, whether it's attitude control systems or separation systems or aerospace structures, you know, the composite structures that form the fairing or the interstage assemblies. So what we try to do is we try to commonize components between our various vehicles. And we have, for instance, we have a flight computer that we use. It's called our modular avionics control hardware. We call it MOC. And that flight computer provides all the command and control and software platform for our launch vehicle. That same flight computer is used on everything from our GQM sea-skimming target that flies about 40 feet off the deck to provide a target for the Navy, all the way up to our Antares, and it'll be on our Omega launch system as well. So we've really leveraged commonality of designs and commonality of components and systems to be as efficient as we can, and we believe that can make us competitive as well.
Alex is in Tucson, Arizona, and he says, I'm curious as to what kind of advanced manufacturing goes into this rocket. For example, you did mention that you were using composites. Are you using a lot of new generation manufacturing, 3D printing, things like that, to reduce the labor force or to minimize your cost?
Yes, absolutely. So part of our production activities for the solid rocket motors, as I mentioned before, is an automated fiber placement capability for these large cylinders. So each of our segmented booster designs is a large cylinder that's about 12 foot in diameter and 45 feet long or so. And so we wind these. We have an automated fiber placement machine that winds these on a tool, and then we have the machining to fine tune the interfaces after the winding is complete. And then we've also developed some automated capability for installation of the insulation that's inside the case. So that was previously done under the shuttle era by hand. That was a manual operation along with a lot of the other work. And so we've been able to automate the production to reduce the touch labor required to produce these rocket motors. Across the board, I think, you know, in also fairing development, we have within our flight systems group here, we have a composite design and production house as well that builds many of the composite structures that are used on Atlas V and Delta IV. So we have experience with regard to, you know, automated production techniques for composite hardware for these large structures. And the Omega vehicle will be a 5-meter diameter, so our fairing will be 5 meters in diameter, that structure will be produced at our facility in Iuka, Mississippi.
So you're not doing any of the production in Arizona where you physically are located?
So we do. So what we manufacture in Arizona is we do the avionics here. We integrate batteries and flight termination hardware here at our facility. We will build the solid rocket motors up at our promontory capability in Utah. we'll build the composite structures in Iuka, Mississippi, and then our plan is to build the cryogenic tanks at a facility in New Orleans at the Michoud Processing Center. So our vehicle will come together. All the avionics and software will be built here and then tested and sent to Michoud, and then we'll integrate the cryogenic stage at the facility in Michoud. We'll bring the RL-10 engines to that facility, and then ultimately ship the completed assemblies to our final integration facility in KSC.
Interesting. So you're all over the board with where it's made, and is that? I'm just curious if that's economical or if that's a political way of doing things to make sure that you get a lot of congressmen on your team.
Well, that certainly helps. But you know, this is kind of the way we've done our vehicles for many years. If you look at the history of the Arizona Launch Vehicle Division site, we've been part of Orbital Sciences since the late 80s. We actually, the group here was purchased by Orbital Sciences. It was the Space Data Corporation that did these little sounding rockets. And then when Orbital Sciences came along in the early 80s, Orbital was founded in 82 by Dave Thompson and a couple of his partners. They purchased the Space Data Corporation in the late 80s, and this became kind of the design center. And certainly we have a big facility as well in Dulles and have a contingent of launch vehicle engineers there in Dulles at our headquarters. But the launch vehicle division and now the flight systems group, which is another part of Orbital ATK that has a responsibility for leading up propulsion systems and aerospace structures, is based here in our Chandler, Arizona office. So over the years, we've done the avionics out of this office. We've done some structure production here, primarily metallic structure type things. We do some composites work here. If you go back to last year, our Minotaur C flew six satellites for Planet Labs. We did a payload adapter, a multi-payload adapter out of our facility here. It was a composite structure that we built here. So we have some production capabilities here, but what we primarily do is we build our avionics and our electronics, and we integrate our systems and then test our vehicles here. So we have our engineering base, all of our systems engineering and vehicle engineering base is here in Chandler. With the integration of ATK, we have the propulsion group in Utah, and they kind of came packed with the aerospace structures group, which really supports the propulsion group in case production activity. So and the aerospace structures group also does a lot of work in the aircraft industry now. So they produce a lot of components for various aircraft programs. So kind of a diversified business base as part of aerospace structures. And, you know, the selection of some of the facilities here is the Michoud selection is really based on a desire for us to develop a friction stir weld tank production capability with kind of a minimum amount of investment. There's an opportunity for companies to go into Michoud and lease space and equipment time on the same hardware or the same equipment that's being used to produce SLS tanks there in Michoud. So that's really kind of an opportunity for us to be as efficient as possible to go in and develop a production capability that we can use and be efficient and then ultimately support our vehicle with a minimum amount of the recurring cost.
You have another question. Jerry is in Pittsburgh, and he said, there seems to be a lot of interest and work being done to develop on-orbit servicing and satellite repair, if I remember correctly, David has done ATK shows with your company is doing in this front. To the degree that this new development industry becomes successful and existing satellites or recently launched satellites can be repaired and have life extension, wouldn't that reduce your number of launches and affect your bottom line? Do you account for the impact of perfecting orbital servicing and repair and life extension for satellites?
Great question. So part of Orbital ATK's big development programs is the development of satellite servicing capability. So we have our space systems group in Dulles has developed the Cygnus vehicle, which is used for cargo resupply, and there's an adaptation of those critical designs, obviously human-rated docking maneuvers to the International Space Station and a lot of commonality of components and capabilities that are being developed into a satellite servicing capability. So we certainly see pressures on the marketplace as we go forward, and that's one of the big reasons why when we look at our return on investment for the Omega launch system, we're not forecasting that we're going to fly 12 or 15 times a year with a bunch of large satellites. We think the market, we firmly believe that we need to show a business case with a reasonable level of launch activities, and we think we've done that, and we have a business case that closes with a reasonable launch cadence.
So you're not too concerned about on orbit servicing negatively impacting that business plan?
No, our business plan has taken that into account, the idea that the dynamics of the market will shift as we go forward. We think, obviously space is critical in a lot of different areas. It's critical in national security. It's critical in communications. And so we see a long-term robust market here. We don't see, we try not to look at things through rose-colored glasses. We try to be realistic with regard to what future launch projection requirements are going to be, and that's one of the reasons why we believe that a diversified business base like we've got here with regard to our launch vehicle division is important for the Air Force, because it shows that we have an ability to produce rockets to make a in a sustainable manner that has been demonstrated over time. Orbital Sciences kind of started out as a rocket company, and over the years we've been very successful expanding into satellites, and then with the Orbital ATK merger, certainly expanding our capabilities into solid propulsion and other defense systems. So we've been very successful at growing our company and showing the stock market and the public that we can produce our products on time and accurately and for an affordable cost.
Ben sent in an email, and he says, I'm graduating with an engineering degree in aerospace engineering toward the middle to the end of summer. And I'm wondering if your company is hiring, and do you hire fresh starts out of school with an undergraduate degree in engineering?
We absolutely do, and we have we are growing, in particular at the launch vehicle division. The Omega program right now has about 100 people supporting it here in Chandler, 150 supporting in Chandler, a couple hundred supporting up in Utah. And we envision growing over the next year by another 150 or so. We have a lot of new programs that are picking up here in Chandler. So I would certainly encourage him to apply to look on our website. There are a lot of positions. There are a lot of opportunities here. I've been here since the early 90s. I started out as an engineer with a bachelor's of science from Oklahoma State in mechanical engineering with an aerospace option. And this has been a great company for me. It's allowed me to grow. It's allowed me to do a lot of things over the last 25 plus years. So would certainly encourage him to check out our website and look at the various opportunities that we have here.
Is it just your regular website, or do you have a special employment website? Do you know?
Yeah, it's just the Orbital ATK website, and then you can look at for employment opportunities. There's an employment opportunities button on the website.
Okay, and for the record, Chandler is in the metropolitan area of Phoenix, correctly? Correct?
Yes, that's right. We're kind of on the southeast side of the valley here in Phoenix, and just a beautiful area and a great place to live. So I would certainly encourage all the engineers that are listening out there who are interested in working on rockets to check out our website and look for opportunities, because we have plenty out here.
When did you graduate from Oklahoma State?
I graduated from Oklahoma State in 1990.
Well, I'm a Sooner fan, but that's okay.
So. Oh, I'm sorry about that.
That's what I always say about the Oklahoma State Cowboys. We're down to a little less than 5 minutes, so what have I missed? What have we forgotten? What should we have talked about? What have I not known to even ask you about that you would like to tell us about?
Well, I'm looking through my notes. I mean, I think we've covered most of what I wanted to get out today. I think, you know, certainly we're excited about this new launch system that we're fielding. You know, we are going to fly here in about 3 years, so we've got a lot of work to do between now and the initial launch activities for Omega. But this is an exciting time to be in the aerospace industry. It's certainly an exciting time for us here. You see a lot of press and programs like this great program that highlights the importance of space and the opportunities of space. And so we're really excited about Omega. We've got a number of new programs and opportunities coming here with Orbital ATK over the coming year or so. So it's a great time to be an engineer. It's a great time to be in the aerospace industry. So, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, David, and kind of walk through the kind of things we're doing here.
I got another email that came in that I'll give you, and this is Randy, and Randy is in Phoenix, actually. He says Phoenix, and he says, you know, government programs are notorious for having political consequences and getting canceled, delayed, or their funding changed. Do you see this as a risk to your business plan, in that the government could change, the Air Force could change, and this particular program could be changed or even eliminated?
Well, certainly every program, there's always risk associated with continued funding, whether it comes from the government or comes from industry. To date, between Orbital ATK and the Air Force, we've invested over $250 million in the Omega launch system to date. So the Air Force has been a good contributor. Orbital ATK has been a great contributor, providing development funds for us to go through concepts and produce the early designs that we have today. So there's certainly always risk with regard to any program, whether it's funded by the government or by independent industry or venture capital, that the source of funds could dry up. But you know, I certainly think that we understand the need for more affordable launch systems in the ELV marketplace, and we think the Air Force understands that need. The Air Force is certainly under a mandate to try to reduce dependence on the RD-180 engine, which is produced in Russia. So there's a strong political urge to move away from systems that are dependent on Russian technology and Russian production. So we again are very careful and conservative with regard to programs we invest in, and that's why it's kind of taken us this long to get to the point where we're ready to move into this phase of launch vehicle development. So we've got a pretty conservative leadership team with regard to where our investments go, and we've looked at this pretty hard, and we believe it's the right time to enter into this market and that we're the right provider and partner for the Air Force.
Over the years, I've been fortunate to see 4- and 5-segment booster tests up in Promontory with ATK. Are any of the boosters that you're designing going to be tested up there, and would the public get a chance to see those tests like we did with 4- and 5-segment booster tests?
Absolutely. So, our Our static fire test plan involves static fire testing of the C-300, the C-600, and the C-1200 rocket motors. So we are planning the C-300 and the C-600 static fires in the 2019 timeframe, and then the C-1200 will be tested in the 2022-2023 timeframe. So we'll have an opportunity. I know we're always interested in public engagement up there, so I'm sure there'll be a public viewing site for those test activities as we pull them together. Again, they're very impressive products, and it's certainly an opportunity for folks to come out and see something that that you just don't see every day.
Absolutely, well worth it, and hopefully I'll be able to attend them when you have them. Mike, this has been great learning about this, and we will follow its development over the next couple of years, and then its deployment into operations, and that'll be really cool. Maybe we can talk again as you get
Absolutely.
Further down the line in development.
I'd enjoy it, absolutely. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you today, David, on your show.
Thank you, and I'll get this archived and send the information to KNU. And we appreciate you being here, and we do look forward to talking to you again. And listeners, that's going to be it for today, and we thank Michael for being with us and for the support of ATK in helping to arrange this program. And then everybody come back on Sunday for our Sunday program. That show is described on our homepage in upcoming shows and our website newsletter, so check it out, and everybody have a great weekend. Thank you for listening to today's Space Show program.